Good evening. My name is Carl Morris. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know if I'm going to be telling you what's happening because I don't even know where I am, to tell you the truth. But I'd like to thank Karen and Carol for having me down here and whoever else is to blame. I was really kind of relieved that you guys were actually here, because a couple of days ago I was sitting in my office and a couple of guys that work with me were asking me what I was going to be doing this weekend, and I showed them the flyer, and they started making jokes, and I'm not paranoid or anything, but I started to believe them. They started making jokes that possibly that this was just a setup of some of my ex-girlfriends who were actually going to have a pig roast, and I was the guest of honor. And so I was glad when you guys were actually here. I really was. And I showed up, and I was kind of lost, and I didn't quite know where to go, and Choice and Maureen sort of adopted me for the last 2 hours, and so I appreciate that. I guess that is what I'm supposed to do, tell you what it was like, what happened, or what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Do that because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that's the way we're supposed to share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'm going to try to stick to that. I didn't start drinking until I was 11. I waited a while. And prior to taking my first drink, I really don't remember having any major problems. I didn't have any giant spiritual void in my belly or trying to escape from anything. I just took my first drink out of curiosity. And I had no idea at the time, but I found out after I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to find out what alcoholism was. And it's my belief, based upon what I've learned out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and what alcoholism is, that I was an alcoholic right within 12 hours after taking my first drink, because of what happened to me over that 12 hours after taking that first drink. What happened was, my parents were out of town for the weekend. I stole a bottle of wine from my father, I locked myself in his study, and I proceeded to drink. And halfway through that first bottle of wine, I got this feeling that, well, I don't even need to describe it in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of you at some point or another know the feeling I'm talking about. I mean, it was warm, it went down, and I just remember it kind of went out to my fingertips, and I remember sticking my little chest out, and I remember taking this big, deep breath, just, I didn't know I'd been short of breath for 11 years. And that's the last thing I consciously remember of that night, was that feeling. And the next thing I consciously remember is I came to in my bedroom the next morning, and as I came to, I realized there was puke everywhere, all over the walls, all over the floor, in the pillowcase. I mean, it was even in my underwear. I mean, it was just everywhere, and I knew I was going to have to puke again, and I made it into the bathroom, and I realized I'd puked all over the bathroom, and I slipped on the bathroom floor, hit my head on the toilet bowl going down, and as I crawled back up to get my head back in the toilet bowl, I felt that wonderful, wonderful feeling that I would feel many times later in my life, and that is how nice and cold that porcelain feels on the side of your face. I just love that. And I got my head back in that toilet bowl, and I started to heave. And somewhere in between the fifth and sixth heave, I suppose, but at some point while I was puking my guts out, I heard a voice, and that voice was mine, and it said to me, "We're going to do this again. This is all right." And see, when I was about 8 years old, our family lived on the island of Borneo in Southeast Asia. And I guess out of the kids, we had all gotten these vaccinations, but I guess one of the vaccinations had missed me. And I had contracted what they call tropical worms. No big deal once it's diagnosed. But for about a week or two, I was just puking. I couldn't eat anything, just throwing up. And when a doctor finally figured out what it was, all I had to do to fix that was to drink some chalky substance and gone. It was done. But when I finally drank that chalky substance and the tropical worms were gone and I wasn't puking anymore, my mind did not say to me, "Hey, maybe we'll try some tropical worms again." Didn't do it. But there at 11 years old, I'm puking my guts out with the same fervor as a few years before, but this time my mind said, "This is all right." See, what had happened was, in that 12 hours, the components of alcoholism became active in my life. Halfway through that first bottle of wine, the book calls it an allergic reaction. The phenomenon of craving kicked in. I lost control over the amount that I drank. I only meant to experiment to find out what this alcohol was and why people drank it. And I did not mean to get as drunk as I got. But I lost control over the amount that I drank. And the next morning, as I'm puking my guts out, the mental obsession was there. Our book says we failed to bring in with sufficient force the pain and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. There I am puking my guts out, and I can't even remember the pain of half a second ago on the last dry heave. And so I believe I was an alcoholic right from there. Now, I didn't have all the major symptoms, but I was just as much an alcoholic there at 11 years old as I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous 15 years later with my life burned to the ground. It's just the age-old correlation that we often make, that if you're pregnant, you're pregnant. You're just as pregnant, 1 week after conception as you are at 8.5 months. It just shows more at 8.5 months. And I started drinking alcoholically right from the gate. Before I started drinking, I was a goofy kid, short hair, playing violin, doing really well in school, loved my family. Once I started drinking, everything changed. Out went the violin, in came the heavy metal guitar, wanted to grow my hair down to my ass. School became a very secondary issue, and my parents became the enemy immediately. A lock went on my bedroom door, black lights went up in my room, posters went up. I had my 8-track player in there, and I'd be banging my head. And I always used to want, as I was growing my hair, I don't know if anybody else ever did this, but I would stand in front of the mirror, and I would put my hair back like this, and lean back to try to make my hair look longer as I was listening to this 8-track player. it's really silly is what it was. But now my parents were very astonished by this change in behavior. They had no idea what it was. But that was a summer, we lived in Seattle, and that was a summer of going into seventh grade. And in seventh grade, a typical morning for me would be I'd show up early for school, certainly not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property. Sort of loser's corner is what they always called it. Every school has a loser's corner. And there was this old beat-up building the school didn't use anymore, and every morning about 4 or 5 of us would climb into this old building that there was a hole in the side of the building. And if we were really, really lucky, we would have an actual bottle of booze. But more often than not, we would have a parents' cabinet mixture, all little of this, little of that, all in a jar, right? And we didn't know what we were mixing. We'd have vodka, whiskey, cream de menthe, vermouth. I mean, it was just, but already at this time, I mean, our book says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, meaning I will bypass taste to get to the effect at any cost. And I'm already doing this at 12 years old. You can imagine seeing about 5 or 6 12-year-olds in there with this booze and hammering it down. Trying to be men, you know, and we'd often puke in a friend's shoe or something. And it was the early 70s, so we were smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? 4-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc days. It was in those Glad bags where there'd be about 9 people spit on it as we'd roll it back up. And we'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into maybe a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if we were really desperate that morning, we'd use a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. We'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves in there, hit the lighter on, the seeds and stems would be popping, we'd be burning holes in our clothes. And we'd look at each other and say, should we go to school? And we usually wouldn't. Now, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous often sort of interrupt themselves and say, I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I really think it's a bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. Just sort of a bizarre thing to apologize for. In fact, the most bizarre example I've ever seen of that, it was a few years ago, I was in the speaker meeting, and this speaker was just given one of the ugliest, heinous, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm in a speaker meeting and the drunkologue gets ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. And I mean, that night I was drooling listening to this guy. You know, I was on the edge of my chair listening to every word he was saying. And at one point in this ugly story, this guy said, you know, I had 4 DUIs, and the judge said if I got one more DUI, I was going to go do 5 years in the state penitentiary. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, I'm in a blackout on the freeway, and I hit this family of 4, and they all wound up in the hospital, and I wound up in the penitentiary. And in the penitentiary, I sodomized men. I was sodomized. And, oh, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. It's like, I was the only one that, like, thought that was strange. Everybody else was saying, oh, that's fine. Mention them anyway. That's right. That's right. So, like, I'm having a terrible, I'm blacking out most every time. It's like playing Russian roulette as a young teenager. You know, when I would start drinking, I don't know whether I'm going to black out or whether I'm just going to catch a little buzz and go home. I have no idea. I just had no idea. And when I was about 14, I got turned on to cocaine by a much older person, and that was just simply to be able to escalate my drinking. And this person gave good advice because it was absolutely true. I could actually now control my drinking. And now I didn't know how to afford this on a busboy's tip, so I had a little paper route, and I was working as a busboy, sort of. And through a series of events, this same older person introduced me to somebody that gave me the most incredible pot I'd ever seen in my life. I remember going down into his basement, and he rolled up this joint, and I'd only seen it in magazines before. That High Times magazine, is that thing still out? I don't know. He rolls up this joint, and I don't know what to expect, and he takes a hit, and He hands it down to me. I'm about 4'11". I don't know what to expect, so I take a big hit, and just boom, it explodes in my lungs. I'm down on the ground barking like a dog. And I always called it getting high, but I wound up on the ground a lot, you know. And I handed it back up to him, and he took another hit, and as he handed it to me, he asked me a question that changed the course of my life. I can picture it like it was yesterday. He had long brown greasy hair, round rose-colored glasses. It was the early 70s, so I'm sure he was wearing bell-bottom pants and platform shoes. And he hands it to me and he goes, "Can you sell any of this at school?" And it's like, oh, yes. Yes, I can. Yes. And so now at 14, I'm the neighborhood drunk and I'm the neighborhood drug dealer. And I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. He was not laughing like Choice is laughing right there. My father didn't find any humor in what you guys are finding humor in at all. But my parents, God bless those people. They tried to help me again and again and again. But you see, they always blame my problems on people, places, and things. If we can get them away from that damn group of kids, things will be fine. If we can get them out of that damn public school system, things will be fine. And you see, people, places, and things are not my problem. My problem is my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. That's my problem. You see, you take somebody like me and you change the people, places, and things in my life, and all it is that I'm drunk with different people in different places with different things. That's all that happens there. But, you know, well-meaningly, they would do stuff like that. And when I was about 17 or 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system, and my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. If we can get them out of Seattle, things would be fine. So they sent me across state to Washington State University, and I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and I got about 10 credits in 3 years. And at any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. I'm not talking a 2.5. That would be a C average. I'm talking 0.25. That's like withdrawals, incompletes, Fs, and an occasional D, maybe in a bowling class or something. Yeah, by the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you about will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards. They would send out a big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And they would send hundreds of these out to people they'd known through the years, and they would receive a lot of the same types of letters back. But when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of the letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know, in no uncertain terms, exactly where I stood with the Morris family. The first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. And the second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in marketing. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in Indianapolis, Indiana. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hopes, dreams, goals, and aspirations are this, this, and this. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. And she's in the church choir there in Indiana. And she's a very happy young woman. We're very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in advertising. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. His hobbies are this, this, and this. He's about ready to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou who works for... Oh, this will let you know how long ago it was. He's about ready to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou who works for a small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. And they love to travel together and golf together, and he's a very happy young man. We're very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. I looked for more. There was like nothing. That was it. I mean, I really have to kind of look back and say, what else were they going to write? Well, Carl showed up once this year, puked on the carpet, wrecked the house, and left. I mean, I don't think they wanted that in their Christmas letter. It was about this same time that, you know, I'd made a lot of promises to my family, you know, when things would get bad over the years, and I'd make a lot of promises to them. And each time that I would promise them that I was going to straighten it out, you could have put me on a lie detector test. And that needle would have shown that I was absolutely telling the truth at that very minute. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. I can tell the truth and promise you that I'm going to straighten it out, that I won't be doing this anymore. I totally agree. The jails and the hospitals and stuff that's happening in my life are really out of bounds. I agree. I need to do something. And you could have put me on a lie detector test, and I would have been telling the truth. You see, I'm an alcoholic. And that sooner or later, I am going to drink and use again. I am. It's just, it's not a maybe. It's not a, it's just a matter of when. It's not if or no. It's, it, you know, it's just when. So it's about this same time that one more catastrophe happened, and my folks have said, you know what? We've tried again and again to help you, and all you've ever done is spit in our face. If you're going to live the way you're going to live, go ahead, but you're not going to do it around here. We don't want you back at this house. We really don't even want to see you in this neighborhood. Just go. Take that car in the driveway and go. Now, my cars. I'd had a lot of cars ever since I'd been 16 years old, and they would always start out as perfectly good used cars. But they would die of alcoholism along the way. I don't know if your cars did that, but mine did. And this will tell you exactly why I drank. If I were physically sober on any given morning, meaning I just haven't had a drink yet that day, and I happen to be coming out of wherever I happen to be living, whether it be my parents' basement or a park, depending on what part of my life we're talking about, and I haven't had a drink yet that day, and I'm a little restless, irritable, and discontent, and I'm kind of twitchy, and just, well, basically just pissed off is what I'd usually be. And I'd walk up to a car that I've owned for a while, and I'd see the dents and the broken windows, and I'd get madder by the second. I just, surely I deserve better than this. And I'd get in that car, and I'd smell the rancid smell of stale alcohol in the carpets. I'd see the cigarette and hot box burns on the seats. And maybe as I'd start it, maybe a friend of mine had puked into the ventilation system the week before, and it's like, oh, man. And I'd turn that key, and it's only hitting on one or two cylinders, and I'd be peering through a cracked windshield, and I'd be driving along, and it's hitting on one or two cylinders, and I'd look over at some other young guy that seems to have his life together, and I'd say to myself, damn it! What do I got to do to get ahead in this effing world? Just a little edgy here. And all I'd have to do is go drink for a couple of hours. And after I would drink for a couple of hours, I'd walk back up to that very same car. Now as I'd approach that car, I'd say to myself, why, that 62 Dodge Coronet is a classic. And I'd get in and it wouldn't smell bad anymore. Then the most miraculous thing I ever experienced prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous would happen when I turned that key. Now I turn that key and it's like, boom. It's like a mechanic had been working on my car while I'd been drinking. Why, this is a driving man's dream. Look at the way they send corners at 70 miles an hour. So like, I'd wonder why I get pulled over. So what I did was I headed south. I basically lived out of my car, showered at beaches, and lived in Portland, Santa Cruz, the streets of Hollywood. The words are demoralizing, and I did that for about a year and a half. Now I'm back up in the Seattle area. I'm sitting in a bar as a teenager, we used to call it bootlegging beer, right? You'd stand outside, you'd get, hey, mister, will you buy us some beer, right? We used to do that at least three times a week. And we always thought these were all losers in this bar. Now I'm sitting in this bar. I know everybody. I'm running a tab. And long story short, I started playing middleman. These guys wanted me to start running drugs up across the Canadian border. And I got to tell you, there's three losers in any drug deal. There's a buyer, the seller, and the middleman. Middleman will make the least amount of money, get beat up the most, and go to jail first. I'll do that. And so I started running trunkloads of pot up across the Canadian border. And, you know, it went great for a number of months. And, well, it went very badly this one time. Just really, really badly. It went so badly that what I did was I joined the Navy. It just went that badly. I would love to tell you that at a certain point in my life, I sort of stopped dead in my tracks and took an honest look at my life and said, you know what, you've been a taker from society, and maybe you ought to go serve your country and get an education at the same time. Love to tell you that, but that's not why I joined the Navy. I was just on the run. And what I'm about to tell you should scare the daylights out of you, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test that qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should scare the daylights out of you that the Navy was even thinking possibly, remotely, or even maybe putting somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at the base on the very first night, and I couldn't pass that test. It's called a urinalysis test. And I was immediately kicked out of the nuclear engineering group and transferred over to this group they affectionately called nuclear waste. And a year and a half later, I was a lower rank than when I first came in, and I'm one of these guys that, you see, during the day, I would know that I was in the Navy, just simply because I'd look around and I'd see I'm wearing the same clothes as the other guys. I'd look in the mirror, I got the same haircut as the other guys. I'm on this gray ship, and I would know that I was in the Navy. I would leave that ship and take a drink, and I'd totally forget that I was in the Navy. Absolutely forget that and you see, I used to see these other guys, you know, when our drink says that, you know, drinks we see others taking with impunity, when I would be getting into trouble, which I was always getting into trouble. In fact, you can always tell a guy that's always in trouble in the Navy. On his work uniform, you can see a faded area where stripes used to be, where you're always getting rank, losing rank, getting rank. You can't keep up with it. And there's always a faded area there on the work uniform. And You know, I would always be getting into trouble, and I would always see the other guys on payday. They would get their check, and they would go out drinking. And they would come back on the very same night. And when I would be sitting there saying, you know, I'm in trouble, I can't do that, and I'd see them doing that, and I'd say, well, I can do that. And I would take a drink, and I would come back 2 or 3 days later. And the Navy really frowns on that behavior. They're just, like, really, really, they get really upset about that stuff. Anyway, after I was in the Navy for about a year and a half, and I was already in some trouble, and this one morning I was late getting back to the ship. It was a Monday morning. I've been drinking all weekend. In fact, I was still drinking. There was a bottle between my legs. And I'm trying to get in, and every military base, there's a guard check where a Marine will stand duty. And you're supposed to slowly pull up. He'll check the sticker on your car. He'll check your military ID. And if everything's in order, he'll flag you forward. This particular morning, I really think this could really happen to anybody, what I'm about to describe. But I think there was a depth perception problem going on. I think it was on my part. But all of a sudden, I could see the whites of the Marine's eyes, and I looked down at my speedometer. I'm going like 35, 40 miles an hour. I tried to swerve. There was a median on the right-hand side. My car hit that, went up on its side, and bam, right through the guard check. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. And my car was upside down, and I'm laying on the roof on the inside. And my only thought was not how is I might have killed that Marine that was on duty. That wasn't my thought. My only thought was, where's the bottle? Where's the bottle? Because I knew they were going to take the bottle from me very soon, right? I knew that from experience. So the Marine was all right, thank God. But what happened to me that morning is the Navy was really angry that morning. And when I was at the hospital, the Navy doctors prescribed for me medical science's best shot at the alcoholic. So it's a little white pill, harmless looking. Got a fancy name. It's called Antabuse. And they prescribed this Antabuse for me and told me, and every single morning before quarters, I would have to show up at sick bay, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue, and I'd have to sit there for a half an hour. What happened to me then was, they also gave me a warning about drinking on top of Antabuse, and I filed that for future reference. What happened over the next week or two is really the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of the disease of alcoholism. It's a part of the disease of alcoholism that we don't understand, and it's until we get here, hopefully, and especially the side of the disease of alcoholism that non-alcoholics don't understand at all, that we could actually be not drinking, and we would, at all costs, drink again. See, what started to happen to me in those couple of weeks when I was on that Antabuse and not drinking is that this knot inside my belly that I would feel very lightly or intermittently, I'd been feeling it since a young teenager, was getting tighter and tighter. And I remember just counting the days on there. I was like, 4 days and I'm on Antabuse. Now it's been about 6 days and I'm on Antabuse. Now it's been about 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes I'm on Antabuse. I started to see the other men on the ship. They were talking behind my back. I knew it. All 300 of them. They were. And this knot was getting tighter and tighter, and I was getting angrier and angrier. And if you would have come up to me and said, hey, Morris, how you doing? I would have said, I'm fine. Just don't like the way the sun feels on my skin, all right? Best way I've ever heard it described of the alcoholic without a drink, with absolutely no program or no idea of what to do, is I heard Cubby S said it. I felt like a scream looking for a mouth. I mean, it's just like, ugh. And my division officer on about the 10th or the 11th day asked me to do a very legitimate task. He told me to swab the passageway. Now, I couldn't believe, I mean, now I know it was a very legitimate task. On that day, I thought, how dare you? Out of all the other men in this division, you ask me to do this lowly task. I forgot I was the lowest ranking man in the division, so I let him know how I felt about this. Now, military officers are very, very concerned with your feelings. They really are. That's high on their priority, list of priorities. And I let him know. I said, you obviously don't know who I am, do you? He looked me right in the eye. He waited a second, and then he asked me what, even up to today, is the most embarrassing question I have ever been asked in my life, even up to today. He looked me right in the eye, and he said, okay, son, who are you? Like, That's a very good question. I had no solution for this, and I snapped, and I went AWOL from the ship, and I locked myself in a little hotel room down in downtown San Diego, 4th and Broadway, the Plaza Hotel. And I bought a bottle of vodka and a shot glass, and I remember sitting in that little hotel room and staring at the bottle of vodka and the shot glass, and the words of the Navy doctors giving me the warning about drinking on top of Anabuse kind of came back to mind. And what that warning was is, son, if you drink on top of Anabuse, you get one of two reactions. One is you'll get violently ill. The other one is you might die. I remember thinking, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. And I took one shot, and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I saw that I was like bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, 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 boom. Looked at my shirt, I was drenched in sweat, and then all of a sudden I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. It's all right. You guys are really sick if you think that's funny. And I took another shot. Now my sponsor, Eddie C, calls this next thing that happened projectile regurgitation. It just came up and out. This, thank God I was in the type of hotel room where the toilet's in the same room as the bed. Now, this was a different type of puking than I was used to. Now, one of the tools for living that I had gained in the 15 years that I was out there drinking was what I call socially throwing up. Now, that's where you can be anywhere. And you got a little buzz on going. You can be anywhere. You can be at your job if you got one. You can be at, you know, at a party. You can be in a bar. You can be driving. You can be, anywhere. You can be in front of your grandmother. You just got a little buzz on going. You get that little warning. Little sour taste comes up in the back of your throat, maybe just a little bit comes up in your mouth, but you kind of, not too much, and you kind of go, and you know you've got anywhere from 30 seconds to 2 minutes to find a place to puke, right? So you if there's a bathroom, you go there. If there's a bush, you do that. If it's your friend's shoe, whatever, right? But you get a little warning. But here on this Anabuse, it was just up and out, but I hung in there. I kept drinking, and I kept puking, and I kept drinking, and I kept puking for about an hour. It would always usually take me for an hour to two, and I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse. That after about an hour or two of this puking and drinking, enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system, and I would quit throwing up. And I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating, and sweating, and I already told you, I'm all right with that. I drank on top of Anabuse from May 5th, 1986, to January 21st, 1987. 7 months. And I got really, really sick. What Anabuse does is it actually stops the liver from processing the alcohol, so you're actually almost getting pure alcohol unprocessed by the liver into your blood system. It gets pretty ugly. About halfway through, I wound up hitting the hospital every once in a while as a result of drinking on top of Anabuse. And about the third time showing up in the hospital, now our big book talks about doctors who are familiar, physicians who are familiar with alcoholism. Right? In chapter 3, they mention that. Now, in the Navy, there are many, today there, and even back then, many, many physicians who are very familiar with alcoholism in the Navy. However, the couple that I was running across during this time obviously were not familiar with alcoholism, because on my third time showing up in the hospital as a result of drinking on top of Anabuse, this one Navy doctor, his solution to my drinking on top of Anabuse was double the dosage of Anabuse. So he sent a prescription of double the dosage back to the ship, and there I was taking that. Now I was showing up in the hospital rapid clips. Of an alcoholic of my variety, and I imagine yours, and it's like, I will pay any cost to get back. I can't imagine not drinking. I just can't. I cannot imagine life without alcohol. I can't. I can't do it. I absolutely cannot do it. And my second to last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in National City. I was told that I was wandering around. A couple of the guys from the ship saw me earlier that night, and I guess I was in a blackout. I was in National City. I was told that I was wandering in National City looking for some crack cocaine. If you take one look at me, I don't know if you guys know where National City is. It's kind of like South Central LA is. Take one look at me. Do I look like I ought to be wandering around at 3 a.m. in a place like South Central Los Angeles looking for some crack cocaine? I mean, I was on foot, too. And anyway, that morning, the Navy had to do reconstructive surgery on my face. They had to reset my jaw. I had 28 stitches in my face. And I drank again with a straw because my jaw was wired shut. My last night of drinking, I was being let out of the San Diego jail, being brought back to the ship by shore patrol, and I was in handcuffs, and it was one of those mornings where I was standing there, and the shore patrol was escorting me up. I'm in handcuffs, and I'm, you know, just sort of my head's bobbing. It's just one of those mornings, you know, and the officer of the deck was reading the orders that had already been processed on me the night before, and those orders said, and he was reading them out loud, that the what was to be done with me was 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or, and he said this very, very sort of disgustedly, he said, or according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, we cannot discharge this loser without offering him treatment first, right? And I remember, like I was saying, just one of those mornings you're in handcuffs and my head was bobbing and I can't really look up, and you know, remember those that feeling, you know, and people around you are talking about you and you're there in handcuffs and you're just going, oh man, you really don't care what's going to be happening to you. You're just going to let them do whatever they're going to do, whoever it is that's talking around you. And shore patrol just turned me around and took me up to that treatment center. And I show up at this treatment center. It was up at the base up at Miramar. That's where the Top Gun school was. Our little section was called Top Drunk. And everybody that showed up in that same week, we were all going to go through this 45-day treatment center together. And on about the third day, this one guy raises his hand. We were all in this kind of what they called a large group, I guess. They were going to separate us into smaller groups later, but we were in this large group. We're all kind of sitting there, and everybody's just kind of sitting there. Nobody's really too happy to be there. I really don't think that anybody had any. It was really not a normal change of duty station. It was just sort of, you were sent there is what was happening. You would be sent there, and we're just kind of sitting there. And this guy that was from another base raised his hand, and he says, his name was Paco, or from some other base somewhere, and he goes, I want you guys to know that my real name's not really Paco. If I'm going to do this staying sober thing with you guys, I really want you guys to call me by my real name. Will you guys call me by my real name? And we're all kind of like, whatever. So, like, what's your name? And he goes, well, my real name's Randy. Will you guys call me Randy? We all said, yeah, whatever, Randy. Fine. That was no big deal on that part, but later that afternoon, the assistant facilitator, who was kind of looking out for us over the first couple of days, brought him back in front of us, brought Randy in front of us, laid a tag with his new name on there, Randy, and told the whole group that whenever staff was not around, Randy would be in charge. So we all hated Randy from the word go. What Randy would do is if you got caught smoking out the bathroom window when you weren't supposed to, or if you were stealing caffeinated coffee out of the staff lounge, or if you're doing any of those things, Randy would turn you in. And the next morning, you would have to do about 150 push-ups, 150 sit-ups, and run about 2 or 3 miles. I started to get in the best physical condition I'd been in a long time. On about the seventh day, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had never run across Alcoholics Anonymous before. I'd never discussed Alcoholics Anonymous before. I hadn't really given Alcoholics Anonymous much thought. I knew there was such a thing. I mean, you really can't be on the planet in the last 15, 20 years without knowing that there is such a thing as Alcoholics Anonymous. But I hadn't discussed it. I didn't have an opinion about it or anything. All of a sudden, I found myself in the back of this room. And, you know, they took us all in a van, and we would all sit together in the back, and they had the meeting. And it was a participation meeting. There's probably about this many people there. And probably 10 to 12 people shared for 3 to 5 minutes. And all I know about that night is that at least some of them must have been sharing responsibly, because I heard what a newcomer is supposed to hear in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard people talking about what happened to them when they did drink. They were saying funny little things and making jokes about it and stuff like that, but I know that I said to myself many times in that meeting, I drank like that. They know what they're talking about when it comes to drinking. They drink like me. And then they were talking about this other thing that they called the mental obsession or the alcoholic mind. And I'm thinking, they think like me. They think like me. And, you know, what they were doing is they were like, as the book says, piling on heaps of evidence cited out of their own bitter experience as to the fatal malady of this disease. You know, and it talks about it in the book, is that's how we're supposed to share with a newcomer. And that's what they were saying it in various little ways. I'll never forget this one guy who in one sentence described the alcoholic mind. It's all he said. He got called on. He walked all the way to the front. He introduced himself. He said one sentence and he sat down. He said, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation. And he sat down. I said, whoa. And I felt great for about 11 seconds. I now know why I felt great. It was identification. But it only lasted 11 seconds because Randy had my cigarettes and wouldn't give me one, that SOB. The next night we went to another meeting and I got very confused at this meeting. At this meeting, everybody was talking about something I'd never heard about before and I couldn't understand what they meant by it. Everybody was saying, well, my drug of choice was, And somebody else would get up and say, oh, well, my drug of choice was. And I was sitting there thinking, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? Next morning, back at the treatment center, I asked the counselor that had been assigned to us. Her name was Mary Weber, a wonderful woman, non-alcoholic. And I said, Mary, last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that? She said, Carl, let's play a little game. She used to like to do that to get your attention. Let's play a little game. She said, if I came into this room and I had a tray, and on that tray I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks, which one would you take? Now, like, I'm 8 days into this thing, so I start drooling. I'm just, I said, I take them all! And she started to snap her fingers to try to bring me back to reality. I'm like, She says, you can only have one. Which one would you take? I thought, well, Mary, if I can only have one, I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, well, then maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? I said, no. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I'd take that ounce of cocaine, I'd get the hell out of here, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. Now I'd have enough money to buy a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. That's what I would do. Now, whatever was happening there, there's two things going on that particular morning. Number one, I'm 25 years old and I'm dying of a disease I know nothing about, but I'm still a smartass. That's one thing that was going on that day. The second thing that happened that day was very, very important and I didn't even know that I learned this that day. And in fact, some of the most important things I learned early on in Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery, I did not know that I learned it on that day, but in looking back, I'd go, oh, I did know that. And it was so very important because it prompted sort of a discussion in that group as to what, you know, clean and sober and sobriety dates. And, you know, I've since that day, I've never been confused like so many new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, have you ever run across some of the you run across a lot of new people, I'm sure. But have you ever heard this? If you go up and say, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? Every once in a while, I hear this. Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. They're like trying to juggle three different sobriety dates here. And you see, it's always people that think that way are people that don't get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. They just sort of stand around the outskirts of a meeting. They don't get involved. They don't do anything, but they hear things. And it's so very, very important. Singleness of purpose is absolutely important. Absolutely important. But when it's worded in the way that at some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, a newcomer who doesn't understand what they're talking about could think, well, if we don't talk about drugs, it must be okay to do them. I guarantee you, a lot of people hear that, and it's not true, because our sobriety dates depend upon being clean and sober, right? And we've got one sobriety date. And if you're brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's very important that you understand that, right? It's not okay to do a little social heroin in between AA meetings and take 30-day chips in AA. It's just not, and that's just not Carl's opinion. That's just the way it is. It's just common sense. So anyway, after 45 days, they're going to let me out of this treatment center. That's just what the orders were. And in the last couple of days before they let us out, they gathered all 35 of us that were going to get out of there on that Friday. And I think it was a Wednesday morning when they gathered all of us up. And they put us in a room, and there was a lectern up in the front like this. And I mean, we were just sitting there going, boy, we're getting out of here in 2 days. Boy, what are they going to do today? Oh, my. And the door opens up, and they got the biggest, meanest counselor to come in. And he was a Marine, and he was in his full dress uniform. And I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive sight. He walked up to this lectern, he grabbed a hold of the sides, put his shoulders up, and he stared us, every single one of us, down. He panned the whole room and just stared at every single one of us and didn't say a word. Just stared at every single, and I mean, you could have heard a pin drop in there. We're just like, ugh! Then he spoke. He said, you 35 have just been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. This is the treatment center that Betty Ford modeled hers after. You should be damn glad you're not getting the $30,000 bill for this. We've been here for years, and statistics through the years have shown us that only one out of you 35 will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into sobriety. But only one. By our statistics through the years, it's shown us that only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. And I mean, if it was quiet before, it was like dead silent now. All you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it wasn't going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It was going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. Like, by now, he's like the poster boy of the treatment center. At 45 days, this guy's turned in term papers on acceptance. He's got little footnotes at the bottom, page 449, 452. Oh, by the way, what he was quoting there was treatment center statistics, not the statistics of success in Alcoholics Anonymous. The statistics of Alcoholics Anonymous are in the foreword of the second edition, and I believe those statistics stated there in 1955 are just as true today. Many people often say, Alcoholics Anonymous is becoming diluted. It's no longer, only 10% are making it, whereas back in the book, there's a difference. It's not true. I believe it. They're still just as true today as what it says right there. But we have to look at exactly what it does say there, because what it says is, of those that came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and of the remaining 25% of those that stayed on, they showed some improvement. Still true today. Of those that come to Alcoholics Anonymous and really try, that would mean like get sponsors, work the steps, have commitments, go to meetings, 50% would get sober and remain that way. It's true. Now, many people often view, they go into any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and meetings are getting big, and there's those that are doing AA, and then there's those that are watching AA. And they think they want to throw the people that are watching AA into the statistics of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's really kind of silly. And they want to throw people that just sort of like hang out at a couple meetings here or there. They don't have sponsors. They don't get commitments. They certainly go nowhere near that big book, let alone do what it says. Right? So why would we throw them into the statistics of whether Alcoholics Anonymous works or not? That'd be kind of like if you were the person that does the statistics for the Chicago Bears or something, and you're doing the rushing statistics for the year, and you threw in a couple of guys that were up in the stands all year watching, and you threw them into the rushing statistics. Well, that would bring your statistics way down now, wouldn't it? Yeah. So anyway, I don't know why I went off on that, but so anyway, on this Friday afternoon, they're letting us all out of this treatment center. There's about four or five of us out on the front doorstep. Our seat bags are our feet, and they were bringing cars out of impound. Anybody who did have one, or they'd found my car down in San Diego. Somebody, my division officer, had sent my chief down or something. They'd found where I'd been arrested, and they found my car. They put it up in the impound up at Miramar. When they brought my car out, they brought out what I call my Rolls Canardly. That's the kind of car that rolls down one hill and Canardly make it up the next. It was a 68 Volkswagen with a hole in the floorboard, had to push start the damn thing, and had a headlight that no matter how much tape or wire I'd put on it to get it straight, it would just flap around. And we're kind of standing there kind of fidgety, and all of a sudden one of the guys that I'm standing there with goes, "Hey, look over there." He points to the other edge of the parking lot, and there's a car coming at us fairly slowly. One of the other guys goes, "That's Randy." Sure enough, as you got a little bit closer, it was Randy. "Yeah, that's Randy." One of the guys goes, "He's drinking." "No." Sure enough, as he got closer, we saw it. He had a pint. He was pounding that thing down. As he rolled by the front of the treatment center, he rolled down the window, threw the bottle right at the treatment center, gave us all the finger, and drove right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. So, the next thing that I remember of that day is that I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach at the North Shore Alano Club. It literally was a gong show meeting. It was a participation meeting, and they actually had about 3 or 4 people sit up at the front, and they had a gong. And if they didn't like what you were sharing, they would signal each other, and it was like, bong. You had to sit down. I guess that was their way of stopping newcomers from raising their hand. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know why they did that, but but anyway, I'm sitting in the back of that meeting. The truth about my life at that very minute was, I'm 45 days without a drink or a drug. I've got a lot of information about alcoholism and drug addiction. I'm in the best physical condition I've been in. That's it. There'd been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I had information, feeling better, 45 days. I'm sitting in the back of that meeting. If there was ever a turning point in my life where my life hung on the wire, that was the day. And I didn't even know it. I had no idea. Now, I'm sitting in the back of that meeting, and all I ever wore when I left that Navy base, when I'd stop by a gas station, I'd do this quick change thing, and I'd put on my black leather pants, black leather jacket, black tank top, black boots. I'd stand in front of one of those wall blow dryers, get my hair to stand straight up, and I wore long dangly earrings and sunglasses at night. A friend of mine told me at that point in my life I was suffering from what he calls IRS problems. That's imaginary rock stars, what that is. And I'm I'm sitting in the back of that meeting, and I don't know a soul. I don't even know that my life's in danger. I don't know enough. One guy that night, operating on his primary purpose, leans over to me and said, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, and I said, "I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center. Got me. I don't know what I'm doing." His eyes went bing. Big smile went across his face. He's like, "Got one." It's like he's one of these guys that trolls the back of meetings for newcomers, you know, of the same sex. And, you know, it was like, there's guys in meetings around all over Alcoholics Anonymous, all over the world, that do that. They just troll the back of the meeting trying to find that one lost character. And, I mean, this was a big deal when they catch one that accidentally says, "I don't know what I'm doing." It's just like, boo, landed the big fish. Boom, he was all over me. I was wondering, I was kind of shocked. Why is this guy so excited? I now know what got him so excited. Well, the first thing is he'd run across the rare occasion in Alcoholics Anonymous of meeting a newcomer who accidentally admitted he didn't know what he was doing. Now, the second thing that was going on was that this guy was a few years sober, and it was Friday night. But on Thursday night, this guy's girlfriend of the last year or so had left him for another man in his home group. So he was like having a rough weekend. He was wondering what to do with his weekend. Homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was just nuts over this woman all weekend. I mean, it was just bizarre. At one point in this barrage of meetings, this guy got called on to read chapter 5 by one of his friends. And he gets up there and he goes, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves a simple program. Usually women who are constitutionally incapable." And at the break and after the meeting, he'd be off in the corner talking to these old guys, right? And they some of them would be kind of laughing, and other guys would be talking to him seriously. But invariably, at the end of the meeting, if he's off in the corner with these old guys, and I'm just kind of standing, one of the old guys would turn him around, point at me, and he'd come barreling across the meeting. "We're going to another meeting!" And he'd throw me into the passenger side of his car, and he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting. And he'd be yelling at me, "You gotta go to meetings, you gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor, goddamn her! Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, damn her!" And I'm like... So I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so grateful that that man's reaction to his pain that night was not to sit home and whine into his sponsor's answering machine. "She left me. What should I write about?" Right? This guy knew the solution. He knew the solution for his pain and out of self. And he was just dragging me around to meeting after meeting after meeting the whole weekend, right? Actually, what he was doing was trying to find his sponsor is what he was doing. And he was talking to his sponsor's friends, and he was just doing the drill in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think he had any idea whether I would be there after that weekend or not. He didn't even know if I'd be there the next morning. I was just sort of a prop in him trying to stay sober that weekend. And I'm so very grateful that he did that. Because I don't think I would have made it through that weekend. I don't think I would have, because I was in the back of that first Friday night meeting. And I wouldn't have known to go to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have just slithered out of the back of that meeting, gone and pushed out of the car and started driving. And I would have gone, well, treatment was fun. I'm sober. Well, I'm not drinking. Maybe I'll just swing by the bar and I'll drink near beer. That's what I'll do, near beer. My opinion on near beer is, if I'm going to drink some near beer, I may as well go get some near pot and some near cocaine. It's like nearly have a party, I suppose. Or I might have been driving around going, maybe I'll just swing by the crack house and just hold the torch, see how their life is going, right? I think I would have been loaded by midnight. I really do. And by him dragging me to so many meetings in the same area of town over that weekend, I learned something so valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. Because I saw other people going to multiple meetings over that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. But I saw other people that went to two or three, maybe four meetings over the weekend. I saw this one group of guys that were hanging together, and they were at a lot of meetings over that weekend. And they were saying they had 6 months, 6 years. There was a group of them. I saw this one beautiful couple that took were at two different meetings taking cakes for 30 years each. And I was like, wow, I didn't know that you would like go to meetings that way. I didn't know that. What I learned about how we go to meetings, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. That's why they're out there. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, make a plan, and they do one play. And they huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Only in an emergency will they huddle up and do two or three plays in a row. Well, it's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the game around here is one day without a drink or a drug, you're a winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. We go, remember, we're bodily, mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this, try a little of that, do a little of this, and we run right back in here and we huddle up. And we'll remember, we're bodily, mentally different from our fellows. Just before we break, some guy in the corner might go, wait, hang on. I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broke and I'm bored. What do I do? Someone like Choice will go, get a job, son. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of that, try a little of this, and we run right back in here. And it's so very important that I remember that I'm bodily, mentally different from my fellows out there, but equally important that I remember that I'm bodily, mentally similar to you in here. And it took me a while to really understand, what does it mean to be bodily, mentally similar to you in here? If each one of us told us the facts about our lives, things that are going on in our lives, where we had been, where you know, our ethnic background, our prior religious beliefs or political ideas or anything like that, it's going to be a world. Just like our book says, we are people that would normally not mix. We're from a whole cross-section of society. We have a million different stories as to, but you know what? If we start, see, if a woman, a 400-pound black woman from Nigeria, lesbian, could get up here, and if she starts talking about what happens to her when she does drink and what happens to her when she tries not to drink, I'm in there. I'm just like her. See, that's what it means to be bodily and mentally similar to you guys. And I had to understand that if I have that body and mind, I'm doomed to an alcoholic death. Or I can be here and laugh and scratch and enjoy the best life possible for a human being. And it's my choice. You know, the book says it so wonderfully. I mean, in the second paragraph in We Agnostics, it says, you know, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. What that really is saying is what Alcoholics Anonymous says to every new person. So, if you're alcoholic, do you want to live or do you want to die? And most new people go, well, how much of life are we talking about here? Right? And I had to learn how to live from you in here. Because you guys have this strange way of living. Believe me, living the life of Alcoholics Anonymous is a very strange life. You know, we run into these smoky, well, they aren't any smoky rooms anymore, are they? It's all non-smoky. We run into these rooms and we like talk, and we go out and we do stuff and we do weird stuff. We react weirdly to things that very differently. I mean, we got some guy sleeping on our couch and we wake up and the TV's gone. Most of us usually go, did it again. You know, normal people call the police. We just kind of go, did it again. You know, we live this really weird way. We really do. You know, we take known felons into our house. And we feed them, let them sleep. We do really weird stuff, really weird stuff. And we also do these really strange steps. And I mean, but the thing is, I had to, the way this, I was introduced to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely amazing. I was about 4 or 5 months sober and our ship had to go out to sea. And my sponsor had become, at that point, my first sponsor was one other recovering alcoholic on my ship. And he told me I had to meet him in that very aft end of the ship every night when the ship was out at sea at 6:30 p.m. And he brought this book down. And the very first night he put the book down, he said, well, you've been sober for a while. Have you read this book? And I said, yeah, I've seen it. I've been at meetings. I mean, you read chapter 5 all the time. And so I said, well, yeah, I've been at, there's like how it works. We antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. And if you go to the noon meetings in Covina, you can really find the group We Antagonists. But you know, the truth is, at that point, I wouldn't have been able to tell you the difference between Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Bob, and Dr. Paul. You would have asked me that, I wouldn't have known the difference, let alone what does the doctor's opinion say and what does it mean in my life. And unless I can truly self-diagnose myself and really understand the fatal malady that I'm dealing with, how can I seek a solution? And I had to be in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out what it says I am and what I'm dealing with, to understand why I have to take these bizarre actions and bizarre steps in my life. And we sat down there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean every single night from 6:30 to sometimes 9 o'clock, 2.5, 3 hours a night. He would read, I would read. He would read, I would read. And he was sharing with me what he had learned from the book studies and his sponsor that had been taught to him. And we stopped, and he would try to explain it, and we would discuss it, and he would be saying, does that relate to you? And I go, yeah. Does that apply to you? Yeah. Then he'd say, well, there's good news. You're in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can stay here one day at a time. Bad news is, if you don't, you're a dead man. Just that simple. It's just that simple. And so he got me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the very first time that I went through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, in those few months that I did that, I got what I just call a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. That's like it says in the Appendices Spiritual Experience. I did not get the real deep and meaning in life that I've gotten by staying here in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't get the real healing in my life, the real meaning to life, until I did what he did for me. Until I did that with other people. When I started helping other people through the steps like I had been helped through, that's when the real healing took place. I guarantee you, for the first couple of years of my being sober, what I'm telling you tonight, and we're kind of laughing and scratching about, nobody was laughing. I didn't see anything funny about the things that had happened in my life. I mean, I would have been one of those ones that said, my life sucks. It really sucked coming up to now. And by working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and then helping others work the steps and going and reviewing through my life, I have found the greatest sense of relief and the greatest, I just think what happened to me out there was just hilarious. But there was like nothing funny until I had actually gotten in and done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 2 years sober, I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. I was an electrician when I was in the Navy, and prior to getting sober, they wouldn't let me stand watch on a light switch. My very last night in the Navy, as the ship was pulling into sea and I was going to be discharged in the morning, honorable discharge, amazing that I'd gotten that. I was standing watching what they call the EPSI console. It's the electrical control panel that controls the whole ship, all of it. And I used to giggle late at night saying, one push of this button by an idiot like me and the whole ship goes dark, you know. But I didn't. They told me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can think crazy stuff, but just don't do it. Just don't do it. I think I would have been in the Navy a little bit longer had I done that on that very last night. Probably in the brig. But one of the amends on my amends list was, other than I had to make payments back to my parents the 2 years that I was sober while in the Navy, just an allotment out of my paycheck, just straight up to my folks. But I still owed them for this bachelor's degree that they had paid for. And I had been given two choices by the men in Alcoholics Anonymous how to make amends for that. See, they had paid for a bachelor's degree, and I had not. Well, I didn't have one. So I either could pay them back for it, which would be a lot of money and take many years, or I could go get what they paid for in the first place. Now, I did not go to school when I got out of the Navy to get that bachelor's degree because I thought it would be a good idea. I wasn't one of those ones that thought that. I did it because Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if I didn't make the amends, I would not be able to stay sober. And so I moved up to the Los Angeles area to go to school, and I wound up in the Covina area. That's where the school was that I had signed up for, and I remember by having to make financial amends while I was in the Navy, and I was getting a Navy paycheck every single month, I was still driving that little Volkswagen that I had to push start because I just had no other money, because all of it went out just to try to get even with society. And I was driving on up to, going up the 605 freeway, and I remember it's hitting on one or two cylinders, and I'm looking, and my windshield is cracked, and I know I had to push start. There's a hole, and I'm seeing the white lines going through, and I'm going, and I'm thinking, you know, all right, I'm out of the Navy, and you know, I'm going to be up here, and I'm going to have to go to school. I got to get a job. I'll stop by some meetings when I get a chance. And I remember looking over at some young guy blazed by me in the eyes going, damn it! When am I going to get a life in AA? Where's mine? I'm 2 years sober. Where's mine? You know, I'm about ready to make a deadly decision of that. I'm going to try to get in meetings when I can, and I'm going to go get a life. And I'm so grateful. I accidentally pulled into a noon meeting in Covina, and I remember pulling in and getting kind of disgusted because the parking lot was flat. Where I got sober, there was a little bit of a hill. After the meeting, I could easily push start the car. This parking lot was flat. And I remember thinking, should I leave the car running? Or I parked it, and I came in, and I met the sponsor I have today and have had for the last 9.5 years. His name is Eddie Cochran. Incredible man. He's 46 years sober now. That means he was 10 years sober when I was born. And this man literally changed the direction of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. By being around that man and following him and taking his advice and just being a part of his life is, first of all, such an honor. But right off the bat, I tried to explain to him, well, I'm going to school, and I got this little job cleaning up this construction site, and I'm real tired at night. I'll get to some meetings when I can. And I was trying to explain to him that I was trying to build a life. And he said, Carl, that you know, it's wonderful going to school and having a job. It's a great thing for a young man recovering from alcoholism. But those are the things that we do in between meetings, Carl. Meetings are not what we try to fit in between building a life. And that whole thing just completely shifted how I was looking at what Alcoholics Anonymous was. For somebody like me, I don't know about you, I suppose, but somebody like me, Alcoholics Anonymous has to be the center point of my life. It has to be my life. And in between what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, then I do things. And you know what? By taking that point of view, when I was 5 years sober, I was getting a bachelor's degree. I was actually co-valedictorian. And my whole family flew down. It was when they really recognized that their son was actually doing something with his life. And it was an amazing, amazing thing. Eddie also made me start working with newcomers right off the bat. He said, you have to put newcomers in that car of yours. Take them to meetings. And I'm going, Eddie, I have to push start the thing. One of them might fall through the floorboard. And he said, Carl, if you do that, your life will get better. And I didn't see how my life would get better by putting new guys in my car. But hell, he was 10 years sober when I was born, so I did what he said. And the very first night that I put newcomers in my car, my life got better. Right after the meeting, I realized my life got better. The new guys were push starting my car for me. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. You know, there's three things that I really, really believe in. And one of them is that, you know, I'd far rather go to way too many meetings than to go to too few. I would far rather go to this meetings, and then die, and whoever it is that we meet, whoever talks to us when we get to the other side, I'd far rather go to way too many meetings and have whoever it is that meets us say, you know what, you could have stayed sober on half as many meetings. I'd far rather that happen than to find myself sitting on a bar stool going, I wish I went to one more meeting. You know, it's kind of the same idea as that I'd rather live my life as if there is a God and die and find out there isn't one, than to live my life as if there is no God and die and go, oh, shit, you are here. And also, I do know that if I were to take a drink, leave Alcoholics Anonymous and take a drink, right from that second forward, the very best thing that could possibly happen to me is I'd make it back. So why leave in the first place? Why not just stay? See, if I were to take a drink from that point, I'm guaranteed one of four things. Jails, institutions, death, or another chance at AA. Got to say that you get another chance. I've seen hundreds, literally thousands of people come back. I mean, some do, some don't. So that's got to be one of the options. But out of those four, jails, institutions, death, or another chance at AA, obviously the best thing is to get another chance at AA. Well, why not just stay? And so, but I need to know what I need. I need to know what to do to stay. And that is, and you got to get into the book to find out what it is. And if you don't know what I'm about to say, find somebody who does know about the book and they'll explain it. I got to have Unity Recovery Service in my life. If I have those three things in my life, I get to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to have a reasonably balanced life and a very meaningful life. And I get to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I don't have that, then I'm sort of like teetering. And so I want to keep those things in my life. And I'm just very grateful to have been here. And I hope everybody has a very good weekend. And God bless. Thanks.